Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Mindscape Podcast. I'm your host, Sean Carroll. Those of you who have read my book, The Big Picture, will remember that I talk a lot about consciousness, not so much how consciousness works, but the fact that it doesn't need any mystical, spooky stuff to go ahead and eventually explain it. We don't understand the explanation yet, but we have every reason to think that we'll get there in perfectly physical, natural terms. So one of the things you have to establish, if that's an argument you're going to make, even though we don't yet have the explanation, is that it's possible to imagine a purely naturalistic explanation. And part of that is understanding how consciousness could have arisen. And of course, consciousness is an incredibly complicated, multifaceted thing, so it's not one simple answer. There are stages along the way. So I talked in The Big Picture about an example given by today's guest, Malcolm McIver, who is a professor at Northwestern University, about one of the steps that conscious creatures might have gone on, and in particular, when fish climbed onto land. Now, obviously, there's a lot of physiological changes when you go from being an aquatic animal to a land-based animal. But McIver claims that there's also intellectual changes. There's changes in how you think. And it's based on the idea that how we think is strongly influenced by how we sense, which is in turn related, if you want, to the podcast I did with Lisa Azizadeh on embodied cognition, where we talked about how we think is influenced by our bodies in general. Here on today's podcast, we're going to be thinking about how thinking is influenced by how we sense the world. So whether it's through our eyes or our ears, or in the case of certain fish, they have electrical impulses that give them a handle on the world around them. So McIver argues that the transition of climbing onto land gave not only a different way of thinking about the world and looking at the world, but a different mode of imagination. So not only could you see much further once you've climbed onto land, but that fact about your sensorium led directly to an evolutionary change in how you could compete for food and other resources. Namely, you could plan ahead. Suddenly, there is an evolutionary pressure to develop a capacity for imagination, which is crucial on the road to consciousness. So in today's podcast, we dive into this idea. We talk about how we sense in general, how we think, and then the implications of this understanding for how we should think, how we can better improve our actual cognitive capacities, both as individuals and as a species, as societies, how we can plan for the future. We are stuck with the brains that evolution gave us. Can we do better than that? So it's a wonderful conversation mixing ideas from science and philosophy with real implications for how we live in the world. Let me also mention, which I like to do occasionally, that, you know, there's a webpage for the Mindscape podcast. I have a feeling that a lot of listeners never go to the webpage. That's perfectly fine. But if you do, you'll find not only show notes and links to important things, but entire transcripts of the episodes. Those transcripts are, of course, paid for by our supporters on Patreon and PayPal. Also on the webpage, you can find links to become a supporter yourself. Throw some cash at the Mindscape podcast. So the webpage is preposterousuniverse.com, which is my website in general, /podcast. We'd love to see you there. There's also little discussions. You can leave comments on all the episodes. And with that, let's go. We're all driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. You can ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree that Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites. And Mindscape listeners will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get their jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Mindscape. Just go to Indeed.com/Mindscape right now and support the show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/Mindscape. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Malcolm McIver, welcome to the Mindscape Podcast.
Great to be here.
So we have a lot of ground to cover, from, you know, fish swimming around to planning for the future of humanity. And but you're a somewhat complicated guy, and you're a wonderful role model for a successful interdisciplinary career, being as you are a professor in engineering departments and yet working on all sorts of things. So maybe in contrast with some other people we might have on the show, why don't we talk a little bit about how you got here? Like, what was your academic path that led you to where you are now?
Oh, okay. It's a very tortured path. I guess I began, first of all, didn't go to a formal school, was sort of self-taught, eventually got myself into community college in Canada and used that to get into university. And there, essentially, I was curious about everything, and I immediately figured out if I did a philosophy degree, I could sort of get to do everything.
It's like everything, yeah.
Yeah, but then 2 years into my degree, I started getting quite worried that I might not be able to find a job. So I added a major in computer science.
Oh,
to
very
my
smart
degree.
On both counts. Good.
And something very interesting happened. I started taking classes in philosophy and computer science, which were talking about the same things, like Turing machines and philosophy of mind and the nature of computation. And that got me very excited, because suddenly the thing that I thought I was doing for, you know, a meal ticket was actually intellectually also satisfying for me. And so that sort of led to this whole line in CogSci and AI that I pursued for a while. I started I did a master's in philosophy of science, did a 2-year stint of a 4-year program, PhD program in CogSci and philosophy of mind at Indiana University, which is actually where I was classmates with Dave Chalmers and Anthony Chimero and some other people who have gone on to do really well. But 2 years into that, I decided I was getting kind of frustrated just thinking about the nature of the mind and thinking about the nature of computation, wanting to do something with my hands, as it were, and decided to reapply to grad school and get into neuroscience. And that's eventually led to this program at Urbana, University of Illinois in Urbana, where I did essentially neuroethology, but with a strong computational bent.
You have to tell me what neuroethology
is. Okay, so it's the study of the neural basis of natural behaviors. It has a very long and ancient, maybe not ancient tradition, but old tradition, out of essentially the marriage of ethology and neurophysiology.
I don't even know what ethology
is. Oh, the study of animal behavior. Tinbergen, looking at birds rolling eggs, Conrad Lorenz. These are famous ethologists.
I know those names, but I didn't know the whole Greek word.
Ethology. Yeah, yeah. So
just the letter E, not AE or anything crazy like that?
Ethology, yeah, just ethology. So those two fields got together in neuroethology, and the pursuit of neuroethology is one of looking at things like predator-prey behaviors, any kind of behavior you'd see in the natural world. So rather than bring an animal into the lab and do what is effective for creating scientific measurements, repeatability, yeah. you take what you get in nature, or you try to recreate it in the lab. And so that's there's a whole tradition there, and that's what I pursued, except it was a lab run by a former high-energy physicist who was at Caltech, actually did a lot of work in quarks. Mark Nelson is his name.
So many people are former high-energy physicists. Yeah. It's hilarious.
So as a result, it was a really interesting mix of both, you know, animal behavior and computational modeling and really highly quantitative neurophysiology. So it was a really great training for me.
Okay. And none of this is engineering.
None of this is engineering. So where engineering came in is that near the last few years of my PhD, I was getting more into devising. Actually, we devised one of the very first, perhaps the first robot that used the same principles as weak electric fish to sense objects.
Electric fish are an actual kind of fish.
Yeah, actual kind of fish. They don't get plugged in. They are real animals that essentially emit a small electric field and detect objects, sort of like a bat uses sonar to detect objects. So that's what my PhD was on, was in characterizing their sensory system and modeling natural behavior, prey capture behavior in electric fish as they hunted their favorite prey, which happened in this particular species to be water fleas. Okay. And so, but near the end of my PhD, I got into building robots that duplicated some aspect of their capability. And in this particular case, it was how they use electric fields to detect objects,
the kind
and
of the
identify
deep,
objects.
The underlying theme here is trying to figure out how thinking or cognition relates to the body and the biology.
Well,
is
so
that a theme?
The theme of, I guess, neuroethology is the most effective angle into understanding neural circuitry, which is a lot more conserved across animals than we previously understood. But so you can study a fish, you can study even insects and get a lot of insight into neural organization in general. So the idea is to use behaviors which were highly selected for as levers into the circuitry that supports those behaviors.
Okay.
And so that's really what electric fish as a field is sort of oriented around. And the great thing about electric fish, which is why my advisor and many other people with quantitative or physics or electrical engineering backgrounds have gotten into them, is that whereas with most sensory systems, for example, for olfaction, it'd be very hard to give a step impulse. So you can't really go from no odor to full odor to no odor. There's just all this complex mixing going on. With electric fields, when you're working on electric fish, it's trivial to take their field, add a sinusoidal modulation or a square wave modulation, and then look at what their brain is doing as a result. So you can apply all of these techniques from electrical engineering and systems analysis theory to electric fish with very little difficulty.
How big? So these are real fish. How big is an electric fish?
The ones that are typically studied in the lab, the apteranodids, are 15 to 30 centimeters long. Okay.
And is there a vibrant black market in electric fish? Do you buy them at the fish market?
Well, what's funny is that they're actually popular in the tropical fish market. Oh. And a lot of people get them not even knowing that they are electric fish. They have a bizarre body form because they don't – most fish swim by flapping their tails. These guys have undulating membranes at the bottom of their bodies. We call it the ventral fin. And they undulate that sort of like a curtain to move forward and backward. And frequently you can't tell what direction they're swimming in. They swim equally agilely in both directions.
But it's not electric eel. That's something different.
No, electric eels are related. They're actually close phylogenetic relationship to the ones I'm telling you about. But they have evolved a much stronger electric organ, which can put out 600 volts at an amp to stun their prey. And then they can have a leisurely time going around nibbling up the things that are stunned.
So the eel's using electricity as a weapon.
As
the
a weapon.
Fish,
they also have
sense.
Yeah, and they also have the low voltage type to do sensing with.
Okay.
But the weakly electric fish only have the low voltage.
So you get these electric fish, you bring them to your lab, and you put them in a tank, and you zap them and see what happens?
Yeah, you... depending on the experiment, I did a lot of behavior with them. We also did primary afferent neurophysiology, where you're actually modulating their electric field. You take their field, you add some sort of change to it that simulates them swimming by a rock or a plant, and you feed that back into the tank.
Okay.
And
so you're taking them. It's a brain in a vat. It's a fish in a vat.
It totally is, which is – it's really remarkable. You can do virtual reality with very little difficulty with an electric fish because they are sensing electric signals, which you can modulate with perfect control all over the body.
And is that their primary input, or do they also have sight and taste?
They have eyes. They're often blurry and cataract by the time we get them. They don't seem to use them very much. The reports are, the rivers that they hunt in are turbid. So even in the daytime, you can't see more than a few centimeters through them. So it looks like they're mostly used for, is it safe to come out yet? Is it dim enough to come out and hunt at night? They hunt at night. Or is it time to go hide in the weeds?
Right, because their prey are just little bugs.
Exactly.
and they want to stay away from
Although there's a whole buzzing electric civilization of like 200 species, and many of them will hunt they will hunt other electric fish. In fact, many of the fish we get in the lab have like several inches of their tail missing because they've been nipped, and they have their tail is where their electric field is strongest. So it's like a, it's almost like a lure for, and they happen to have evolved a way to regenerate their spinal cord in that area, which has been a subject of much interest because vertebrates regeneration of spinal cord is obviously an important ability.
But there's an electric arms race among several different species.
Yes, it totally is an arms race with many
underwater,
different underwater
almost
underwater. Yes, the whole pulses went from a uniphasic to biphasic to, you know, all these different modes of signaling to for sexual speciation. And it's an amazing story.
Do we know how recently this developed in evolutionary time?
I think it was, if memory serves, it was around 100 million years ago that they branched off of the non-electric osteoglossomorphs, I think it was. I should know this better.
We're not going to judge you. Yes. Okay. So, how did you hornswoggle Northwestern University into thinking that this was engineering somehow?
Well, so I came to actually here at Caltech, where we're recording, and worked with Joel Burdick, who's a great roboticist here, and we did really fun work now on making a robotic replica of the locomotion system, which turns out to have all kinds of fascinating properties.
The locomotion system of the fish.
So this rib and fin locomotion system, which gives them bidirectional motion, forward-backward motion with amazing agility. And so we built a robot here, several robots here, that replicated parts of, well, the entire rib and fin, essentially. And we had a scale model. I remember this, the first one we did was with wheels and servo motors. And the last one we did was quite long. It was about a meter long. We had it in a flow tank in the basement of the mechanical engineering building, and did a variety of fluid studies of it. And
Want to know one of my favorite sounds? Here it is. That's the sound I hear when I'm learning a new language with Babbel. And if you want to learn a new language this year, I guarantee it'll be one of your favorite sounds too. Babbel is the science-based language learning app that actually works. Babbel is designed by real people for real conversations in a series of quick 10-minute lessons that are handcrafted by over 200 language experts to help you start speaking a new language in as little as 3 weeks. I'm going to be traveling to France for the first time in a long time very soon, and Babbel's helped me reconnect with how to speak to merchants, how to order food, without having to consult a language app. Here's a special limited-time deal for Mindscape listeners. Right now, get up to 60% off your Babbel subscription, but only for our listeners, at babbel.com/mindscape. Get up to 60% off at babbel.com/mindscape, spelled BABBEL.com/mindscape. Rules and restrictions may apply.
It seems that having electric fields as your primary sense organ is a weird thing in the animal kingdom.
Yes.
And also having this locomotion is a weird thing amongst underwater dwelling things. Is there a relationship between
these
two weird things?
There is a very tight relationship. And so the way it goes is these are animals which will typically when they're hunting, you'll see them hunt backwards, you'll see them hunt forwards. There's a great advantage to hunting backwards, to moving backwards while hunting, in that by the time the prey or object of interest has gotten to their mouth, they've scanned it with their electrosensory system. So because it's a really near field sense, you kind of need to drag it across the receptors of the body before you can identify it. So if they're swimming backwards, that's really easy. You know, they've scanned it by the time it gets to their head. If they're swimming forwards, what they do is they do this sort of they'll rotate or something to get closer as they're swimming forward. Then they'll do a rapid corkscrew back, sort of back to get the object if it's something that they want to eat.
So the relationship is that this electric sense is very useful, but it's short range.
It's short range. And if they were to try to – if they only had a big tail fin and they had to go forward and circle around, they would have lost the prey because they can – so I spent much of my PhD quantifying exactly how far they could sense their objects of interest out to. And for a, 15-centimeter fish, it's something on the order of 3.5 centimeters for a millimeter size prey. So they're hunting really these particular species that we're talking about, which is Apteronotus albifrons, are hunting really, or the black ghost, much sexier name, black ghost knifefish, hunt these millimeter-sized water fleas. And so they can only sense those 3.5 centimeters or so away. And so if they were to swim forward and circle back, they would have totally lost.
Game over.
Yeah.
Now, isn't this obvious evidence in favor of intelligent design, the fact that the fish have both this locomotive mode and the electric field sensory mechanism?
Yes, absolutely.
Or do we have an evolutionary understanding of which came first?
It's a good question. I don't know if we know from the fossil record which came first. I suspect because undulatory swimming is actually not that uncommon. It wouldn't surprise me if that might have come first. But and there, in fact, there are these non-electric fish like Xenomestis nigri, which has a ribbon fin, and they use passive electrosense but don't actively generate it. But again, passive electrosense is a super short-range sense, and so having a ribbon fin kind of goes with that. So it may not be active electrosense dependent, but it might have co-evolved with either active or passive, probably passive first. I think that's the ancestral condition.
Okay, so you worked on the locomotion aspect of the electric fish as a postdoc here at Caltech, and then and that does sound a little bit more engineering-y to me, right? Like how things move in weird circumstances.
Right. And so what I was doing with Joel was trying to figure out what roboticists call the small-time reachable set of the animal, which is
what do
given,
human beings call that?
Which is essentially where you can get to given any feasible control input. So for a car, you can go forward and backward initially, and with some turning of your wheels, you can kind of get an hourglass shape, and then you can do parallel parking and such. But you can see how that shape evolves in your mind's eye as you get more time from an kind of an hourglass shape to more something like a circle. And so I was curious what this would be for electric fish, since this is actually something that was actively being worked on by some kind of geometric differential geometry people who are interested in the problem.
So some mathematicians pushing around vector fields.
Exactly.
Were interested in these fish.
Yeah. Well, they were originally doing it for Carangiform, or the tail flapping type swimmers.
Okay.
And I wanted to do it for the ribbon fin swimmers. And that got me into, this is a motor volume, or as I now call it, or small-time reachable set, that has this very interesting geometry at small-time scales that changes at larger time scales, and it has this very interesting relationship to the sensorium of the fish.
I just want to pause here because it is kind of amazing to me the relationship between motion. Maybe it's not that surprising when I put it in these words. The relationship between the motion of objects and organisms and differential geometry and higher mathematics. Yeah. I remember there was there's this wonderful little book on differential geometry by Walter Burke, where he gives an explanation for why people find it difficult to get an intuitive grasp of parallel parking.
Uh-huh.
And he says it's because it involves the non-commutation of vector fields.
Lie brackets.
Yeah, exactly. Because you have the operation of moving forward or backward. Yeah. You have the operation of turning your wheels right or left, and they don't commute. It really matters which you do first.
Yeah.
And if you understand that perfectly well, it helps you parallel park.
Exactly.
And so I can see why if you had different modes of moving, the differential geometers would become interested in that.
Yeah.
And so that got you interested in differential geometry, or
it got me very interested in differential geometry. Although I didn't pursue it too far. At about that time, I got this multiple people emailed me this job that was opening up at Northwestern that was looking for a neurobiologist also trained in engineering. And
I see.
I cut my postdoc about a year short, just as I was getting into the more arcane and interesting aspects of the differential geometry approach to these animals. But it did get me interested in how to understand the relationship between sensory spaces, the sensoria of the animal, and their locomotion ability, which has led to many interesting avenues subsequently.
Right. So once you're at Northwestern, you're still studying the electrical fish.
Yeah.
But you become, I mean, it sounds like from the story that you had some initial interest in thinking, you know, how the nervous system was working.
Exactly.
And then you became interested in the sort of more mechanical
locomotive
aspects.
Yeah.
And then now you're a faculty member, you can do whatever you want.
Yeah.
And so you start thinking more about thinking and the nervous system.
Yeah. Yeah. And so the way that went was, roughly speaking, the last bit of my postdoc was this paper characterizing exactly how these sensory and motor volumes coordinate over different timescales. And at the end of this work, I decided it would be fun to look at how visually guided animals underwater, how they coordinated their sensory spaces with their locomotor spaces. So in particular,
you'd figured out some relationship between this very special weird thing, this beastie, the electrical fish, that can sense a certain distance around it using electric fields, and you related it to this weird locomotive thing it has.
Precisely.
So you want to know, okay, what about the non-weird stuff?
What is
that relationship?
Well, right. And so just, to quickly summarize, the electric fish's sensory volume looks like a cylinder around their body. Okay. And their small time reachable set or their motor volume is essentially a cylinder as well. And
so
how they get that cylinder out of their actuator is a really interesting problem, which we solve, but I won't go into the details. But then the question is, for an animal that looks forward, and so now imagine in your mind's eye sort of a pie-shaped wedge of space in front of them, and then they have a tail flapping system that only pushes them forward into that space, into that wedge of space. And they can yaw or turn left and right, roughly proportional, somewhat related to the angle of that pie, so pie slice. And so I was interested in characterizing how those two things coordinated in a visually guided animal. And so we did the calculations and some estimates, and turned out that I expected to see something. We walk around with this giant sensory volume ourselves, visual sensory volume. And my intuition was that that visually guided fish underwater would have this giant pie wedge thing that they would be moving around looking for their prey. And it turned out to be really pathetically small, and so small that I thought there was an error in the calculation.
Sorry, which one was small? The sensorium?
The length of the pie.
Pie? The sensorium pie or the locomotion pie?
The sensorium pie. Okay. So these visually guided fish hunting for small bugs don't see them very far ahead. And it was such a small distance ahead, I thought there was a problem with the calculations.
But they can move very quickly. They can get far, but they can't see far.
Correct. And I thought, this can't be right, because, in fact, what matters for all of these animals is not the static volume, but the sweat volume through time. So as you because they're searching for empty space or relatively empty space for food, for live prey. And it turns out the sweat volume for the electric fish was almost identical to this pie wedge shaped sweat volume that the visually guided fish have.
The shape was different, but the volume
shape was different,
the same.
But volume was almost the same. Okay, now electric fish have to pay for every joule of the energy that they're investing in electric field, whereas visually guided fish are parasitizing the sun's energy. So there's a difference there in the bioenergetics, but nonetheless.
So it can't be a coincidence that these two very different organisms using two very different mechanisms have evolved the same sensory volume.
It was bizarrely similar in size to me. But so eventually I nailed down that that it's simply due to the attenuation length of light and water. So it turns out that water is a terrible medium for seeing with light.
For eyeballs,
and I just didn't, I guess people who do scuba diving and work in submarines can tell you this from their experience that suddenly things appear out of nowhere. But, I didn't have that experience. But So the numbers show it really clearly, and you lose a huge amount of information on the order of meters. And that's imperfectly like laboratory clear water. It's not a function of turbidity.
Right.
If you add any particles in the water, then your range really goes down to nothing. So that led me to – I was at that time getting interested in what happened to vertebrates at the water-land transition in the Upper Devonian. Why did fish – evolve limbs and all the other things they needed to evolve to come up onto land.
Yeah.
You know, what was the basis of that? And it occurred to me that vision must have changed greatly after the waterland transition, because suddenly you're going from a medium, which is like a huge thick blanket on your sensorium, to essentially infinity. Like, you can see a distance further than is, in most cases, behaviorally useful.
Well, we can see the moon, right?
It's you can see the moon, yeah. and so and you're not going to hunt for prey on the moon, so.
Right, so why is, what are you going to do with that knowledge?
So what I was curious about was the eyes of the ancestral aquatic vertebrates were pretty small. And I expected that they got as big as would be useful in this highly attenuating medium. And you can calculate it out, and we've done that. And they are about as big as they should be.
The eyes of a fish.
Yeah, because getting them bigger, essentially your visual range is proportional to your eye size.
But aren't the eyes of a whale really big?
I don't know the size of the eyes of a whale. They usually use their echolocation systems for range.
Okay.
Because the attenuation length of sound in water is similar to the attenuation length of light in air.
Okay.
And so whales and dolphins are a really interesting example of vertebrates that got used to giant visual sensoria doing the one thing that you could do in water to regain that kind of range,
which is
use the high-frequency sound production system that land animals evolved and do it for imaging.
So since I know nothing about this, are there underwater animals that use echolocation that are not former land animals?
Not to my knowledge. There may be like one or two species of these teleosts that use clicks. I'm fuzzy on remembering the species, but I think that there might be a couple of examples. Now, teleosts are very recently evolved animals.
Okay.
But there might be that case. But
anyway, the ancestors of dolphins and whales got, you know, used to this luxurious broad sensorium, seeing the whole world, and they somehow cleverly figured out how to reproduce it underwater.
Exactly, yeah. And so now you asked me a long time ago about how does this connect to thinking. And I'm very interested in a relationship between how far away you can sense objects and how you modulate your behavior. So the intuition there is just think of yourself driving too rapidly down a foggy road, and you see something suddenly. You don't have a lot of executive planning that's going to go into deciding what to do next. You're going to swerve, you're going to brake, but in any case, you're going to do something simple. And so my thought was that it was be central to the evolution of more complex cognition to be able to sense things far enough out where it makes sense to actually have a plan. And the whole reason I was driven to sort of do a whole bunch of analysis of what happened to vision once we got onto land was an interest in why it is that vertebrate brains got a lot more complex, substantially more complex once we came up on land.
So the idea is that underwater, you might imagine from our, you know, very parochial air land-based point of view that thinking ahead of time is just a very useful skill to have.
Yeah.
But it also has costs.
Yes.
Right? You know, energy and volume in our brains and so forth.
Yeah.
And you're saying that for a fish, it just doesn't help. There's just no point to planning ahead too much.
You can do it, and they do it to some extent. It's just that it's much, much more useful once you come up on land. And energetically, I mean, it's a gift. Like, as soon as you bend that cornea that was inappropriate after you came out of the water, you need to bend it a little bit for the different refractive index. But as soon as you fix that, which can be done very rapidly, evolutionarily speaking, you now can see hundreds of body lengths away. And suddenly you go from an animal which was trapped in kind of a reactive bubble, sort of always driving in the fog, if you will, to an animal which may not have had the neural circuitry initially for anything other than reactive control, to an animal which, with the right mutations, might be able to stall the issuing of motor commands to the motor system and movement towards a prey to think about, you know, well, if I do option A, you know, the prey will run away. But if I do option B, the prey won't run away. So maybe I'll do option B.
This episode of Mindscape is sponsored by BetterHelp. What's the first thing you would do if you had an extra hour in your day? nap, go for a run, read a book? A lot of us ask these questions, wishing we had more time. But the question is, time for what? If you had unlimited time, how would you use it? Therapy can help you find what matters to you so you can do more of it. And if you're thinking about therapy, BetterHelp is a great way to start. What I like about BetterHelp is it's so easy to start. It's entirely online. It's convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist, and you can switch therapists at any time for no additional charge. So learn to make time for what makes you happy with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/mindscape today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/mindscape.
But wait a minute. I mean, this is there's a fraught set of words you're using here, right? Because it's not only planning ahead, it's also using some sort of imagination.
Absolutely.
Some sort of ability to simultaneously contemplate different hypothetical scenarios in your head.
Yes.
And so you're saying that the thing that prodded evolution to develop that capability was climbing up onto the air.
Correct. Onto land. Yes. And so we now know the address of that system in the brain. It's the hippocampus in coordination with the frontal lobes. That you can actually now monitor animals thinking ahead, thinking about different paths when they are given a challenging situation where...
By putting them in an fMRI machine
or
something?
Well, actually, the studies I'm thinking of right now are ones on what's called vicarious trial and error in rodents. And those studies, such as out of Reddish's lab at the University of Minnesota, were done with electrodes in the brain.
Okay.
Looking at place cell activity in the hippocampus. Place cells in the hippocampus essentially are activated according to where you are in space. And what they observed is in mazes where there was not a reliable sort of reward location where you'd switch it, so the animal had to sort of think about what to do next, then at choice points, you can actually see the place cells racing down one arm of the maze or the other arm of the maze before they act.
Wow.
So they're pausing there and they're thinking about different futures.
And were these parts of the brain there in the fish and adapted?
No. So there is a part of the dorsal pallium. So this is an area of increasing interest to me because I'm certain I'm not one to say that suddenly we had it. There had to be precursors, of course. And fish have place cells or have a sense of home, I should say. They have a sense of where they are in space. They have spatial maps. They have cognitive maps in the brain. So certainly they have some of the primitive infrastructure for this. But to do planning, to do imagination, there's no evidence. We don't know of fish being able to do this. And that part of the brain, the hippocampus and, of course, frontal areas in mammals, got much, much larger with land animals.
I mean, I do know this work that at least claims from fMRI studies that the part of the brain that lights up when you ask someone in an fMRI machine to imagine a future circumstance is the same part, roughly speaking, as when you imagine ask them to conjure up a memory of a past circumstance.
Yeah.
So it seems to be a bit of
that's
using
sort of
existing circuitry for that kind of thing.
Right. That discussion comes up in sort of analyses of how our parochial thought about memory is not quite right. It's not like a random access store. It's more like a recipe, which once you recreate the experiences in your sensory cortices, you sort of regenerate the experience. That's where that comes up. But this is something a little bit different. This is the hippocampus is this very, very special multimodal structure that binds information across different modalities and does relationships really well. And that is where this imagination at least is one core part of the imagination circuit.
Well, that's always the problem, right? Like we use words that were invented hundreds of years ago, like imagination.
Yeah.
And of course, they have different aspects going on in the brain. But
exactly.
So you pinpoint this particular one and you think you can. So there's a hypothesis.
Yes.
That it's related, that the use of this to do this hypothesizing and future planning is related to this transition from seedling.
Precisely right. So we're now... We did this analysis of what happened to vision from after the emergence from water to land. We did this. We had a hypothesis about what happened to the eyes. Turns out our initial hypothesis was wrong. We thought the eyes would blow up in size after we gave up on the land. And it was much more interesting because we saw a blow up in eye size about 10 million years before we came up onto land.
In the fossil record.
In the fossil record. And it turns out at the very same time, skull morphologies disclose that animals sort of had these flattened skull shapes with these orbits way on top of the skull table. And they look all the world for like crocodiles. So what would they have been doing? Well, it turns out there's this huge bloom of invertebrate life on land at that point, 50 million years preceding the vertebrate water to land transition.
So the bugs and the plants were already up there.
Exactly, yeah. So what we can then say is, whereas in the past we always thought of, if you were to ask what's the most useful body part for getting for bringing us up onto land, you would have said, well, limbs, and everybody thought about the limbs and how did the digits evolve and how did they separate from. Well, it turns out that the eye increase preceded that stuff. Like the separation of digits and all that stuff was preceded by a big increase in eye size. So it looks like what might have happened is something more causally interesting, which is that eye size grew up and showed all this bounty that made it worthwhile clambering up onto land for. And only after that point do you start to see things like rib cages and all these other things that you need to live on land with. And digits, separated digits, all that came after the increase in eye size.
So some fish were lucky enough to realize that if they poked their eyes up above the water, they could see much further.
Yeah.
They got a tiny little epsilon advantage.
Yes.
And therefore their descendants whose eyes were more capable.
Well, we have a theory about that too. There are these breathing holes that are now our eustachian tubes that were right behind the eyes. And we were going through a very low oxygen period. Of the Earth's, in the Earth's history, right at that point. And so we think the animals were actually coming up for a breath of air.
Oh, okay.
And just coincidentally,
they realized, oh my goodness,
there's this bounty of unexploited food, undefended food. And we were so excited that we actually started getting the fossil records of the insects at the time. And you can see evidence for chemical defense systems suddenly appearing in the fossil record about the time that the vertebrates came up on the land.
Chemical defense systems.
So
from
little
the bugs.
Ozoopores, millipedes have these chemical defense systems, which currently are active against vertebrate predators, and they just pop up in the fossil
record. So
they
didn't need
record.
Defense before.
Prior
the
to that, I guess millipedes didn't like eating other millipedes. I'm not really sure, okay. But all the other bugs that were there, it's apparently not a system that was needed before that time.
Okay, so the fish had this evolutionary advantage. Some of them figured this out.
Yeah.
And there was this new pathway that opened up, that there was yet another evolutionary advantage. Oh, I can plan for the future.
Right. So our thought is that, and now we're doing all these computational simulations, and we're almost ready to submit a manuscript that basically shows that if you have a small sensory range, and this is not exactly, mind-blowing stuff. You would intuit it. But if you have a small range, planning is useless.
Yep.
If you have a bigger range, planning becomes progressively more useful.
I know plenty of people who have a small range and are not very good at planning, so that makes perfect sense.
But so what was fascinating is after we did those initial simulations, these were all in open world scenarios, so no clutter, is that we got to this plateau survivability.
So this is your simulation.
Yeah,
so you're
simulation
doing
a computer of a predator
model.
And prey. Yeah, so we have a predator and a prey. Yeah. And we're using Markov decision processes to model the sort of the game between the predator and prey. And the prey has a fixed sensory range. The predator has an infinite range. Anyway, we got to a certain point where we said, this isn't very land-like. And we're getting survivability rates for our prey that are really quite low. And, it seems like they ought to do a bit better. Why don't we try putting clutter in the space? Because that's what land gives you, is lots of clutter, lots of geometry.
It's not fun to play hide and seek in an empty room.
Exactly. Yes. So we tried that and we saw a fascinating pattern, which was planning became much, much more useful, but only in a restricted range of clutter, which matches typical terrestrial ranges. So purely open space, not very much advantage for planning. Total clutter, where all you see is jungle and forest, also not very useful for planning. But there is this sweet spot, mid-level entropy, if you actually calculate the entropy level of the terrestrial space, of the clutter. At mid-level entropies, you get this beautiful increase in the advantage of planning.
And that's because there's some much more complex structure there in the space of possibilities.
Exactly. So now what we see is that every time the prey moves, the value of that move and the location of that move is highly contingent on the predator's location. Because if there's an obstacle in front of it, it's got one value. And if there's open territory where the predator can just lunge, then it's got a totally different value. And so this diversity of values that appear once you have clutter is really what is exploited by planning.
Do we have any idea whether or not the first fish to come up onto land did so in moderately cluttered environments?
Well, so there's lots of good data now on that forest systems were going at that time. So
it's plausible anyway.
Yeah. It's plausible, yes. Okay. For sure.
So I think that's a convincing case that once you're on land in the right circumstances, planning in some vague sense is useful. Is it obvious that evolution had the wherewithal to take advantage of this new opportunity?
Well, it's clearly the case that it did.
Right.
So do mammals, many other mammals, and so do very strong behavioral evidence that many birds as well. The neurophysiology is lagging in that group of animals, but so it's there. There's no question of it.
We do plan. We do imagine.
We do imagine futures.
Some of us better than others, but yes.
Exactly. And so part of this is, well, what's the archaeology of that? You know, how did it occur? Why did it occur? And I'm interested in that question from multiple angles. One is that I'd like to know, why are we so bad at planning? Well, there's tight spatial and temporal limits to our ability to plan. It seems very, very constrained. And escaping those constraints might be incredibly useful, or transcending them might be incredibly useful in contexts such as looming threats that are transgenerational, like climate change, or, you know, possibly AI might be another. But in any case, threats where action has to be regulated, behavior has to be regulated across timescales that are much longer than what we are natively comfortable with our planning systems.
I mean, would you go so far as to relate this emergence of the imagination, if you want to be slightly more sensationalist about it?
No, it's perfect word for it.
To consciousness?
Yeah, so I think that there's – so from my standpoint, there's that's the most productive way of thinking of consciousness currently.
Sorry, what is the – in terms of
the, in terms of imagination. So the first animal that had to examine its mental furniture in order to derive a useful behavioral program, the first animal that had to imagine –
So wait, so you're linking there. We were previously talking about planning in terms of, you know, I could hide under the tree or I could climb on the rock, et cetera.
Correct. Yes.
But now there's a bit of self-awareness.
Well, right. Well, so
is that a necessary part, you're saying?
Well, it seems kind of ineluctably connected in that it is in your brain that you are examining these futures.
And you're part of the future.
And you're part of that future.
Right.
So, of course, it's not everything that people want from the word consciousness. But I think scientifically speaking, what is crucial is having something that is actionable scientifically.
Right.
And from that standpoint, the idea that at least a core component here of what we mean by consciousness is this space of imagination that opens up for purely adaptive, very easily, you know, calculated now, we can show in the simulations why it arises or why it would arise, that it's a perfectly natural response to a challenge that is brought by the interaction of long-range sensing, visual sensing, with this dynamic context where memory is not quite sufficient, where you need to take into account moment-by-moment positions of your threats and act accordingly. So having that ecological scenario drives animals to evolve the system where they examine the contents of their own thoughts.
And is this – I mean, I think that if we conjured up your former classmate David Chalmers here,
yes,
he would cast the hard problem of consciousness in terms of what it is like to feel something, you know,
correct,
the ineluctably first person subjective,
yes,
experience.
Right.
Are you – Is that what you're addressing here, or are you sort of
no,
sliding
I think this
past
is quite,
that to
this
be
is,
something a bit more objectively
right,
measurable?
Right, this is this is not that that aspect of consciousness.
Okay, so you're in the still in the realm of what David would call the easy problem of consciousness,
yes,
which
correct.
Everyone agrees is hard.
Yes, yes.
Okay, very good.
So, and in fact, I mean, as you know, and Chalmers probably spoke to of this, and well, has in many other contexts at least, that there's an aspect of that which seems completely outside of the capability of science. Because yeah. if science is supposed to be intersubjective, then if this is something that has to be subjective, then it can't, you know, so therefore the ontology has to grow, et cetera. And so, yeah, but that's way beyond what I'm talking about. I'm talking okay. about something very practical, which is the space of imagination where we would ourselves figure in that imagination.
Yeah.
And so that's the first moment at which ourselves sort of became a, well, an item of thought.
Right. Now, self-awareness is clearly an important aspect of anyone's definition of consciousness. Yeah. And so that's what you're getting at.
Yeah.
And so I have to ask the obvious question I'm sure everyone asks. What about the octopus?
Yeah, so
octopus
the octopus
never climbed up onto land, did it?
So I finally, I just recently wrote a proposal to look at these guys.
So we should say octopuses are really, really smart.
Well, so that
in
that,
some sense.
So everybody who looks at them carefully has told me, you know, don't go so fast with that because, you know, of course you hear things about them looking at people opening jars and then going and doing the same, but I've heard from the same people who have done a lot of work on them that, you know, they're able to do it once and then they can't ever do it again.
They don't remember how to do it.
Well, or that it was actually they got lucky or something like this. So I'm not denying that it looks like they
are
do.
Anti-octopus? Are you prejudiced against octopuses?
They're such a thorn in my side, as soft as they are. No, I think there's something very interesting going on there, and here's a couple of thoughts. One, octopus are this, you know, they're nudibranch mollusks, meaning they're unshelled, meaning they're unarmored.
Yeah.
And yet they're this delicious protein that can't swim very fast, and they're hunted by the animals with the greatest sensory range in the water, which are dolphins and whales, which have turned their sound production systems into these amazing long range sonar systems. So they have had to survive by their wits. And furthermore, they're hunted by, I just learned from Roger Hanlon, who's done a lot of work on them, that they're preyed on by diving birds, who are also extremely intelligent animals and can right. see very long distances from above. And they typically hang out in shallow areas. And these birds dive and hunt them.
So it's hard out here for an octopus. Is what
so it's hard, really hard living as an octopus because they don't have great escape mechanisms. They're great food. So possibly, and this seems terribly ad hoc, so I immediately grant that this may just be a completely different way to evolve cognition than what the land vertebrates have done. But it is interesting that that they are preyed upon by some of the smartest vertebrates. And it is interesting that they have these tremendous eyes, although I would argue because vision is so useless for the most part, at least as a long-range sense in water, that vision is giving them things like acuity for manipulation
and
that sort of thing.
They're not very good at but the design of the octopus brain, as it were, is utterly different, right?
It's totally different, yeah.
It's like spread out all throughout.
But that's not necessarily, you know, so birds also have a very, very different design for their brain, but they also seem to have something like a hippocampus-like structure. And there's a part of the octopus brain that people have identified as being possibly hippocampal in nature. So one thing that seems to be the case is that nature's very good at evolving the correct solution regardless of the starting point. So if you need a hippocampal-like structure, then if you start it off as invertebrate stock, you'll come up with it,
right.
if that's what you need.
Okay. And so let's get back to, we did the octopus, got that out of the way. Octopus lovers out there.
I'm glad that was a totally satisfying answer.
I mean, I know that there are people I know who are very smart, ethical people who won't eat octopus, you know, because mm-hmm. it has a certain level of intelligence. I think these are very good questions. And I'm not dogmatic in any direction about them. I have no idea what the right thing to think is. So I'm very curious.
I'm hoping to find out.
Good. We'll have you back when you find out. That'll be important. But okay, so back to the vertebrates.
Yes.
Where we live.
Yes.
So you have this hypothesis, and the hypothesis about the relationship between imagination and climbing up onto land. So there's some evidence in the fossil record that the evolution of eyes did what you might expect it to do
exactly.
under this scenario.
Right.
Is there evidence one way or the other for the evolution of brains doing what you'd expect it to do?
Well, that's tricky because they don't fossilize. And so what we can do is you can do things like look at commonality between the structure that is hippocampal-like in birds and in mammals. And their last common ancestor lived about 50 million years after the water-to-land transition.
Okay, so it's not great.
So there's a big argument. Was it parallel evolution? Was it convergent evolution? Yeah, so it's really hard to know how far back that goes from the fossil record.
Okay, I'm going to take a time out.
Yep.
Because the sun is going to come into my eyeballs. Don't worry, I will edit this out. Right, because when we can't get actual fossil records, the best we can do is look at the different things that are alive today and
exactly.
try to roughly map them. It's very hard. It's hard because I'm very interested in the origin of life. And you can think about the simplest organisms that live now, and you might think, well, they're closer to what life like when it started, but they're still billions of years away.
Well, not only that. So one of the places we can look is at the pallium, which is the structure that's thought to be the ancestral to hippocampus dorsal pallium in particular, and part of that. And we can look at it in teleost fish, and I have colleagues of mine who've done this and have found evidence for things like spatial maps there and so on and so forth. A tricky thing there is that our last common ancestor with those animals was hundreds of millions of years ago, and so they've been busy evolving you know, potentially novel structures, more complicated and unique in their own ways, right? So you have to be careful about comparisons of extant creatures to get at, to reverse engineer or back calculate what happened long time ago. So not to say it won't be eventually possible. There's increasingly this realm of sort of recovering soft body structure by high cat, essentially scanning, imaging, fossils that were really well preserved, and people are starting to be able to see neural structures that way. And so maybe eventually we'll be able to tell more. Hippocampus is pretty deep in there, so at least for that structure, I have to be a bit skeptical. But
yeah.
Do you ever wonder where all your money went? Like every single time you look at your bank account? Honestly, it's probably all those subscriptions. I felt that way too until I got Rocket Money. Rocket Money helped me see all the subscriptions I'm paying for, and it was eye-opening. Between streaming services, fitness apps, delivery services, it all adds up so quickly. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year, with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/Wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/Wondery. rocketmoney.com/Wondery.
But nevertheless, we are going to fearlessly draw conclusions from this line of
totally
reasoning
fearlessly.
For human beings.
Yes, yes, yes.
So there is the thought that if this story is right, whether or not it's right, there's the fact that our much beloved and vaunted ability to plan and think and be conscious is reliant upon what's in our brains.
Yes.
And if it did come from, like, evolution does not have teleology. It doesn't aim toward the future.
Right.
It just responds to the moment.
Yeah.
And does this story of how we got here have lessons for where we are now?
Yes. And I think the answer to that is yes. And so that's where the research is going right now is clearly we have some capacity to plan for the future, but it seems to be both spatially limited, as in we don't think about spaces very far away from us. I'm not thinking right now about a trail in Africa I might go on in a few hours. And we don't think about things very far away in time either. You know, we might stretch ourselves to think about our retirement, but not very
often.
We're not
even very good at that.
We're pretty bad at that. And then what are we going to do about problems that are, you know, multi-generational, such as climate change, right? And so I'm very interested in what the biological mechanisms are for the setting the length of our planning horizon. So, and there's some very interesting work going on right now on that, and I'm hoping to contribute to that. I recently got an award from the NSF to look at this in mice with Dan Dombeck at Northwestern, where we're going to essentially study planning in rodents and giving them a whole bunch of challenging environments, including predator-prey contexts, and start to look at what sets the time base of the horizon. So, you know, can we extend it by to days or to weeks or to months? Or is it something that anything beyond a few minutes is purely through cultural technology?
So the idea is that, you know, the fish naturally from evolution plans seconds in advance.
Yeah.
And once you climb onto land, now at least minutes make sense. Like the time that it takes between when you see
possibly
the lion.
Possibly tens to minutes.
Right. Okay. Yeah. But clearly human beings can do a little bit better than that. I mean, maybe dogs and cats can't. Now that I'm thinking about it, I'm not even clear that my cats can do seconds in advance.
Right.
But how can we do – so, I mean, maybe the first question is, why can we even do that?
Well, right. I think that we can do better than that is interesting. And the way in which we can do it, as in its I'll call it effect of valence – like how much we care about the things we think about far in the future or far in time, I think it's very telling. And from that perspective, Peter Singer has this great analogy of, you know, I'm sure you've heard it, Singer's Pond, this thought experiment of you're driving up, you've just bought a $5,000 suit, you're driving by a pond, you see a struggling child in the pond, what do you do? Well, of course, you get out of your car and you run into the water, destroy your suit. Well, his question is, why don't you send the $5,000 to save a child whose life would clearly be saved by that $5,000 who lives in Africa? And my answer to that would be, well, you have a very carefully titrated system between your care system, your planning horizon, and it all sort of meshes, but it meshes in a very local way.
And that makes sense in terms of evolution, why it evolved.
Precisely. And so getting beyond that, I think, is a hard bargain, at least in terms of getting it natively with circuitry. So we can think about cultural technology to do it. But it would be nice to identify at least what's constraining us in terms of biological mechanisms. So if we wanted to in the future, or in the sci-fi future, to be able to go in with electrodes or some sort of neuroprosthetic, which would extend our planning horizon, that we could do so. Right now, we don't know enough about it to know how we do it.
Are there even other animal species that do manifestly plan weeks in advance?
Depends on – so
I mean, there are
animals that cache, et cetera.
Food,
so it depends on So some of this can be sort of assimilated to instinctual behaviors that are genetically hard programmed.
Right.
And so it's clear that the animal has no explicit representation of this occurring. And they're just – and if you interfere with their routines, it's very easy to throw them off and they just repeat, right? But so I think squirrels and birds and other mammals have seem to represent planning at least on the order of – days, if not weeks, for caching purposes. Beyond that, I think it gets really fuzzy because of this issue of could it be just genetically hardwired?
Right. But for humans, doesn't it make sense to think, and maybe this is just too simplistic, but I have this idea that, you know, there was a phase transition when we became, you know, the ability to express ourselves abstractly and in language and communally that gave us away. Maybe this is what you mean by the cultural artifacts.
But yes.
Even just individually, I think that this gives us an ability to conceptualize the future that isn't just hardwired.
Absolutely. It does. And my suspicion is that the gap between that kind of rationality and our this sort of local care system, where our native sort of planning horizons mesh with care, where motivation also has a seat, is kind of the thing that we need to really crack in order to motivate ourselves to regulate behavior to affect timescales far outside of our natural range.
Right.
So in other words, you know, so a looming existential threat that might be multi-generational in scope, how do you motivate yourself now to do X, Y, Z?
Yeah.
Right? And obviously, we could have something like the climate change panels that are telling us we need to do this now, and governments, if they're responsible, will do that and impose things like carbon taxes, et cetera. But on a personal motivational level, I guess that's where that gap can start to really affect us between the natural sort of care system and the cognitive system that a bunch of people discussing this can say, look, we need to now reduce our carbon footprint by this amount or else, right?
I do think that there is – this may be a little parenthetical and off track, but that's okay. That's why we're here. There's a question of how much you should care about things in the future or things far away, right?
Exactly.
I had Tyler Cowen on the podcast, and I called him – he wasn't happy that I called him this, but I called him the temporal version of Peter Singer.
Yes,
Because he was you know, advocating that we have essentially a zero discount rate for caring about the future.
Right.
Now, he had certain policy recommendations that followed from that you can disagree with, but it's an interesting philosophy question. Should we care about people far away and people in the future just as much as our near neighbors and our current selves?
Right. So there's the normative question of how ought we discount the future. And then there's the empirical. And empirically, we are hyperbolic discounters. So we don't, essentially.
So explain what that means.
Well, so the value of a future harm or benefit rapidly declines with distance from the now.
Right.
And the function that describes that decline is hyperbolic.
1/x.
Yeah.
Right.
So Cowen and others, there's others who have discussed this in the literature, think that this discount rate is inimical to our future survival. And I think that's correct.
Because if you don't care that much about people far away, then...
Then you act the way we are now, which is living for the moment, and our future generations and possibly the next generation be damned, right?
Yeah.
And that's deeply problematic. One could ask, is humanity worth surviving? That's another level up. But if you care about humanity...
We can grant that for the purposes of this conversation.
Okay.
Humanity or its descendants would be a good thing to have around.
The pro-octopus person would say,
I know, exactly. You know,
humanity be damned. Like,
I've met people who think that it's better not to have humanity around.
Yes.
In all seriousness. But okay, I'm not going to invite them onto the podcast. Some bridges I'm not going to cross. But okay, yes. But I just think that I'm just sort of putting this out there. Maybe I've said it before in the podcast. I do think that I'm sympathetic to the idea that we should care more than we empirically do about people far away and people in the future.
Yes.
But I'm not sympathetic to the idea that we should care about everyone equally.
Right.
No matter where they are or when they are. I think that it's sort of mathematically ill-defined to do that.
Sure.
And, you know, I think that there's a practicality issue, you know?
Yeah, there is.
I don't have any $5,000 suits, but I certainly am not giving away all of my worldly goods in the way that would best benefit mankind.
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, it's kind of impractical to imagine people doing that. There is something to be said for balancing being good to the world and being good to yourself.
I fully agree. And in fact, I'm going to forget the name of the philosopher. He's Canadian. Has written this paper on the paradoxes that arise from zero discounting. And there are many.
It's not really practical.
In many of the same ways that Peter Singer's approach, so being the temporal version, inherits, it seems, some of the same paradoxes that the spatial version that Peter Singer pushes.
But I get it as limiting concepts, reminding us how far away we are from that ideal. It's very useful to talk about these things.
Yeah. I mean, I think if we even went 1/10 of the way, we would do much, much better than
okay, we are. So how can we get people to better? I mean, this is the practical implication of what you're doing. So, you want to get people to be better at taking the future seriously.
Exactly. So my initial thought was maybe if I could really quickly figure out what was going on in the brain to support the horizon we have, I could just invent a prosthetic that everybody would put on and suddenly they'd be like taking their recycling out.
Or a pill.
Or a pill. I've subsequently decided that neuroscience proceeds too slowly.
the world will be 1,000 degrees.
That was that my naive, optimistic self 10 years ago. And now I'm the leading climate people say we have a decade to two decades to really do something, or else it's catastrophe. Right. I believe that's correct. So I've been pursuing cultural technology to try to address the problem. And it was inspired by a book called The Myth of the Rational Voter by Kaplan.
By Kaplan, right.
And in that book, he talks about the concept of rational irrationality. Mm-hmm. The concept of rational irrationality is that if the belief if the cost of false belief is low, then you're going to have irrationality. So it's sort of an economist's take on epistemology.
Yep.
Low cost, high irrationality. And so that got me thinking, well, how can we make something that is outside of our perceptual bound, outside of our sensory envelope, that we really ought to care about? How can we make it real? How can we get what is sometimes referred to as skin in the game for something like that? And so myself and a couple collaborators, Moran Cerf at Northwestern, have been pursuing a study, which we just completed. A little over 150 people participated. Half of them were climate denialists and half of them were believers in climate change, where we had them play a climate prediction market that we created. So there are bets over a period of 30 days on things like, will California have more wildfires in the coming month than they did a year ago at the same time, and a whole bunch of things like that. And people got $20 of money to play this market. And, you know, if they do really well, they could potentially earn a decent amount from the study. And so we just finished it actually weeks ago. We've got all the data sewn up, and I can't wait to get back to analyze it. There's a number of things I'm excited about. One is that I do think that, there's this issue of, well, how much in the next 30 days can you say is actually due to climate change and so on and
sure.
so forth.
That's fine. However, that's why you have many questions, right?
There are other things that lead me to think that this could be successful regardless of whether or not that's a problem. For example, as a result of this sports betting, there's been a lot of research on what effect does sport betting have on people's behavior?
Oh, yeah.
And the data is clear. It more than triples participation. Now, causality there is unclear, right? So if you're a sports buff, then perhaps you're going to both bet and watch three times more NFL games, which is what the data show. But there seems to be a huge engagement effect. Once you bet money on something happening, on an outcome, you get engaged. And we just like people to get engaged with climate knowledge, with climate information. Yeah. So one of the questions we asked in our survey, pre and post study survey, is how many climate related stories did you attend to in your media, scape before and after the study? So we'd like to see whether there's an engagement effect, which could be quite different from, whether or not you get skin in the game effects.
I recently came across a study that was not that, but similar. And I actually found it on another podcast. Barry Lamb has a Hi-Fi podcast, High PHI for philosophy.
Uh-huh.
And so he quotes this study. I think it's by Bullock. But I'll get the reference and I'll put it on the website. It was, there's this very well-known difference in beliefs about certain factual things between Democrats and Republicans, or conservatives and liberals. Like, did the budget deficit go up or down during the Clinton presidency?
Hmm.
Right? It's a fact. Everyone knows there's a number. What do you think the number is? And there's a gap. And they said, okay, as they give the survey to some people and they see what the gap is, and then they give the survey to another bunch of people and they say, we'll give you a dollar if you get the answer right.
Yes.
And suddenly the gap goes away.
Yes.
Basically. Yes. So people are much better. There's an expressive component to giving opinions about things like that, even when they're facts. And when you actually put the skin in the game, charging them a dollar, then they're more likely to get it right.
You're probably aware of this. So Hansen, who came up, one of the people who came up with prediction markets,
Robin Hansen
at George Mason, has tons of examples of this, where it seems to take a trivial amount of money to actually close that gap. So it's almost like it's unlinked from the monetary value. Just the fact that you have any actually causes a huge change in your epistemology.
Yeah, no, I'm familiar with this from playing poker, because poker is the most boring game in the world if you're not playing for money. Because people don't act rationally. Yeah. They're like, all right, let's do whatever. Yeah. And like play for a couple of pennies and like, I want to win.
Well, that's a fabulous metaphor for people's position on climate change.
That's right. Yeah. So, okay. So I can see how putting a little bit of skin in the game makes people act a little bit more rationally. How do we implement that to save the planet?
Well, so the idea would be if we could universalize such a market. Suppose there's this tiny 1% tax, carbon tax, and it goes to people being able to play in this carbon or on this prediction market.
Yeah.
It'd have a huge number of beneficial effects. One effect would be that you'd get wisdom of the crowd effects. So there's a whole bunch of things happening to the climate right now that a very, very small subset of which are being attended to by scientists. Things like, for example, ice roads in Alaska having to close much earlier than normal. Things like my friend in Pasadena's garden is being overtaken by this invasive species that likes warmer climates. You know,
the whole wine industry is changing dramatically.
There's that.
They're making champagne in Britain.
There's that. So all of these, you can create these positions on the market, and now it becomes an instrument by which we can see what climate change effects are occurring, and it becomes a prosthetic, if you will, for understanding what changes are occurring over what time scale, and that the market might be a means by which we attune our behaviors to longer temporal sort of concerns.
But are you imagining essentially forcing people to play in this market or bribing them to do it?
Well, I suppose I haven't thought that far in advance, but if one could universalize the market and have a small amount of a carbon tax go into everybody's pocket, and they could either just leave it there as sort of direct profit, or they could play this market and possibly amplify it based on their knowledge, then the people who would want to play the market will do so, and those who don't.
I mean, it relies on the idea that in some sense we have the cognitive capacity to plan far in the future and get it right, but there are sort of shortcuts that we often take that prevent us from doing
precisely so. Right. That I feel we need to bring it into – we need to bring these very slowly looming phenomena, be they climate change or a future AI. We need to bring it into the planning range, our native planning range.
Right.
And a mechanism for that would be to change the costs. So to make it costly not to.
Right.
Right.
Change the incentive structure.
That would, change the incentive structure, but in a way that we can sort of get our arms around spatiotemporally speaking. And I feel like a prediction market would be one way. It's probably just one of many ways, just the first one that we thought was worth testing. But there are other approaches, and the principle is basically get skin in the game, as in your skin now during your life for something that might otherwise, take a very, very long time.
Climate change is the obvious example of our failure to think on long horizons. But my favorite example is actually solar flares. I don't know if you're very familiar with this idea, but
I've heard you talk about this.
Yeah, well, I had a lunch with a lawyer who was on some committee to look at this. Like, he's not a scientist or an engineer, but like he got the expert testimony.
Yes.
And the claim, which I'm still not sure, I haven't really dug into the evidence for it myself, but the claim was, look, solar flares happen all the time, but really big ones are rare.
Uh-huh.
We're not sure how rare because we have not been collecting data for solar flares for that long, right? It is absolutely possible that on timescales of once per every 1,000 years, we get a solar flare that would be big enough to essentially wipe out the entire power grid of the Earth. and millions and millions of people would die because they'd be without power for months or something like that, right? And it's not that costly compared to the downside to harden the grid and save it from this.
I see.
But no one is going to pay the money to do that when you say there's a one in a thousand chance per year that this could happen.
Yes.
We just can't do that calculation. We're not very good at it.
Yeah. It needs to have happened at least once in the modern period.
Yeah. So we're just nothing in evolution ever trains you to plan on timescales 10 times longer than a human lifetime for obvious reasons.
Right. Right. I wonder if that's maybe that's a good Planet of the Apes movie in the future.
I think that things like that are because, you know, scare people a little bit is useful if it's a good scare. Like the China syndrome was kind of silly, but and Day After Tomorrow was kind of silly for different reasons. But yes, we can apply art and culture to that.
Yeah.
Which reminds me, we'll end the podcast by, because people need to know this, you were the science advisor on a very well-known, culturally important TV show.
Caprica.
Caprica, that's right. Which was the follow-up
I'm not
to Battlestar
sure
Galactica.
Yes. Not sure if it falls into all of those categories, but yes, that was a great experience, being able to go through every script and be a part of that show.
Do you think that there is value, or how much value do you think there is in scientists engaging in that kind of engagement with popular culture? It's not outreach in the sense that, you know, you're not learning neuroscience from watching Caprica, right?
Right.
But maybe by nudging the script in certain ways, you're inspiring people. What is your thought about that?
Yeah, I think that there's lots of ways in which it enriches the shows, and in particular, the script writers aren't necessarily well trained in science, typically not, and so when they are thinking about how do I portray this AI breakthrough or this roboticist, they're going to take off things from the shelf which, you know, are probably things that they saw in movies and stereotypes that they have from pop culture, actually, and don't track with what is a much more interesting and fine-grained sort of thing that's going on in reality. And so what we're able to do is sort of add some nuance there. But also, I mean, there's the great thing about Caprica has had lots of interesting philosophical aspects to it. You know, this whole sort of going into VR and the concept of having, I remember talking with the show writers for a long time about how do we have death in VR?
Mm.
And that was a really fascinating problem to puzzle over, and eventually decided on something like a game that you got kicked out of once you died.
Yeah,
and it was a really important game because this is in the context of the show. It's the one game in which this person could see their daughter who died and now lives in this virtual reality. And so, getting kicked out of the show really meant something very meaningful, right?
And did the influence flow the other way? Did working on Caprica in any way influence you to think deeply about the looming AI menace?
Well,
the robot takeover.
I think that Battlestar Galactica and Caprica did an amazing job of envisaging this whole arc, right? And there's these beautiful moments of Battlestar, for example, where the Cylon, one of the Cylons, I think it was Boomer, says, I'm not sure humanity has a right to continue existing, and just pushes
it's
on
all
sorts
challenge
of,
for us, right?
It is a good little challenge, and I feel like the way they envisaged our sort of moral prospects with AI was a fascinating and deeply thought provoking one. So, yes.
Well, we do hope that your work and the work of others we've had on the podcast will help stave off the Cylons from taking over at some point. Malcolm MacIver, thanks so much for being on the podcast.
It's great to be on the show. Thanks.
If you travel, you know when it comes to love.
See you soon.
Can't wait.
The sky is no limit. You know with your Delta Amex card, being oceans apart means meeting in Aruba. And booking a war travel with your card means saving 15% on Delta flights. You know, kissing under the bridge of sighs guarantees eternal love. Because you're the long-distance lovebirds. It's why you're a Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card member. If you travel, you know. Take off 15 discount not applicable to partner-operated flights or taxes and fees. Terms apply. Visit go.amex/you know.